Okay, Rick, you got one.
Okay. I had trouble understanding the teaching that deep sleep was a pratyabhijna.
No. Deep sleep's not a pratyabhijna.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Or because, you know, the knowledge that I've been in deep sleep seems like indirect knowledge to me, like the same sort of knowledge when you say, I know there's no elephant in the room. I look back at my experience and I say, well, I had this experience of lying down with my eyes closed, and then I had this experience of getting up and feeling rested, and there are these 6 hours I can't really account for, and the sun is up. So I guess I sort of deduce, I infer that I was in deep sleep, but I do experience dreams, of course, but I feel like I don't, the experience of deep sleep is inferred.
Well, let me tell you what pratyabhijna is so that we'll get that out of the way first. Pratyabhijna is recognizing that an experience that you had in the past was your experience. So it could be even remembering that you went skiing last winter, that you were the one that went skiing. The pratyabhijna is the memory of that event being belonging to you, right? The you that is here now.
Right.
That's the point. And so when we think about in the waking state and dream state, that's kind of easy because the state with the subject-object relationship within the waking and within the dream state, it's much more easier from the standpoint of this body-mind sense organs remembering a past event and right then and there having a pratyabhijna.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's true for waking and dream, but it would have to be the dream character having the pratyabhijna in that case. Okay, but here for us, I have a pratyabhijna in the recognition that dream state, that I was the dreamer, this I who is the waker, that I was the dreamer. Then there are pratyabhijnas within the dream, you know, and within the waking state. But here now, for when it happens from the waking state, in the dream you're not going to have a pratyabhijna. You do, but you don't think about it, right? Because the buddhi isn't functioning in that way. But from the waking state, you can have a pratyabhijna that the dream, that experience that you had was your dream. So that's a pratyabhijna. Now, so another thing to be clear there is when you're having a pratyabhijna of the dream being your dream, right? You're remembering that dream. You're like remembering a past experience that you've woken up from. Is that clear?
Yes.
So just to contrast to that, to how you could be thinking of it, is that the character within the dream has some sort of a pratyabhijna. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to have, they don't have any a recollection of any type of waking state. You don't remember the waking state from the dream state. You only remember the dream state from the waking state. However, when you contrast the two states of experience, they are kind of identical in terms of their reality in relationship to the Atma, in relationship to the Self. They're both nitya. Okay, so pratyabhijna in reference to the dream state and the waking state are both recollections, because I remember that I had a dream. I'm not inferring that I had a dream or anything like that. It is a memory. Okay. In the deep sleep state, because you can say, I slept and I didn't know anything, that's a memory. That's not a non-existence, and that's also not an inference. Whereas how you're looking at your state of deep sleep is maybe the experience. Edward's kind of like that too. He has this same kind of question. The deep sleep is so, if you're a very deep sleeper, it's like you fall asleep, and then you wake up, and 8 hours have passed. And you have no, it's like boom, boom. Like if you've ever had an anesthetic in a surgery, that is the weirdest thing in the world, you know? They count you down, all of a sudden, you're awake. They count you down, 199, 98, 97, I'm awake.
In another room.
Yeah, in another room. Yeah, he's your friend, huh? And even though you're really dirty and have all kinds of stuff over you, he's not good. Okay, so even if you're, there should be some sense for you, like if when the example they use, I slept well last night, meaning that my sleep wasn't interrupted by waking up or, hey, what's going on? It wasn't interrupted by waking up. It wasn't interrupted by dream. There's no subject-object relationship at that time. You know, that should be something that most people are aware of that.
Sure.
Now, you could have such a deep sleep that it's like closing your eyes and opening them. That's like an anesthetic. You know,
mm-hmm.
where there is no, all of those mechanisms of consciousness are kind of completely shut down so that you won't have any memory of the operation, you know. But is that what deep sleep is like for you? It's like closing your eyes and opening and with nothing in between?
Well, I think what happens, I mean, what it seems like to me is that it's not like that, but the reason for that isn't because I remember any of the deep sleep, but I remember going into it and coming out of it. So,
but if you were to go ahead.
So, for example, I remember that my deep sleep was not interrupted. I didn't wake up in the middle of the night. But again, that's like the elephant not being in the room. That's an inference. I don't remember waking up in the middle of the night. So that's good. That must have meant I have a deep sleep. But if I wake up in the morning, I have no idea what time it is or how long I've slept until I look up to see if it's light outside, or I look at a clock.
Well, that would be true for anybody. Mm-hmm. That part would be true for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're asleep, you're not marking time, because there's
right.
no subject-object
right.
relationship. So that's not going to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
But that you can say, I didn't have any experience, I slept well last night, I didn't even dream. That's mm-hmm. all memory, because the experience is actually there. There's nothing to infer. There's no reason for an inference, because it's your mind that has gone into that condition, right? So you're not inferring something.
Mm.
There's not a second step involved. It's just a simple memory.
Mm.
But your question is a question, this type of thinking, this questioning is often asked. And even philosophers or people in the different darshanas will go through this. Whether it's an inference, is sleep an inference? Or is it, what means of knowledge allows me to say that there's deep sleep? Because we all say there's deep sleep. From the Vedantic standpoint, because the vritti is there, it's just in not unmanifest, it's in its causal condition, but it's still being sattva, still reflects consciousness. And so therefore, since it reflects consciousness, consciousness is not a knower. So there's not going to be a knower known dichotomy there. But the vritti itself, you know, is known, is illumined by knownness. So just to make this, just talk about it a little bit more. If you go into a meditative state that we call nirvikalpa samadhi, I've talked a little bit about this in the class. If you're contemplating and you do kind of the drisha viveka, your mind, your buddhi, is relaxed and quiet and turns toward the self, at that time, initially will always be savikalpa samadhi, where the mind is still present and aware that the only content in that mind is consciousness. Because the content, the nama-rupa content, name-form content, is completely... We've totally withdrawn your sense organs, and you've quietened your mind and turned your mind inward, so there is no name and form content. Like if I'm looking out, this is just a big, huge display of name and form. If I'm letting my mind be, relaxing my mind, and then all of these kinds of thoughts are coming through and settling down, and I could be daydreaming, all kinds of things. But if I bring my mind to a state of quietude, and then I turn it, just to consciousness itself, then its only content is consciousness. And initially, like the borders of my mind are the mirror, the nature of my mind itself, there's still as though a subject there, a reflection there in the mind, which allows it to be aware of the self that is me. So there's a duality, subject-object duality there. Even though the content is only me, the mindness of the mind has not been overwhelmed. But if that's held for a moment, it will turn into nirvikalpa samadhi, where there is no knower known, just me, just consciousness, period. So kind of like in deep sleep, it's not deep sleep, but it's similar, in that in the deep sleep, there is no knower known, right? So no marking of time, in either one of them, no marking of time. Only difference is that in the nirvikalpa samadhi, there's just pure, the experience that you're left with is nirvikalpa, is pure consciousness. In this one, it's kind of pure ignorance. Mm-hmm. Now, when you, in either state, you come out of it. The mind comes out of that as though non-dual state, whether it's non-dual ajnanam or non-dual awareness. Non-dual ajnanam is not quite right, but it works in this particular example. Now, when you come out of it, if you come out of the deep sleep, when you come out of that, then you're awake. The room, the one who went to sleep is the one who's awake. There's a pratyabhijna there, right? And there's also a recognition. If I were to ask you what it was like to be asleep, you can talk about it. You can talk about it. And when the example we use is, you know, I slept well. That's the example we use. Now, the example you use, and this is just a little aside, it's tangential just for a moment. The example that you use is, you know, I remember going to sleep, because you remember going to sleep as long as the subject-object duality was there, as long as the mind was awake, you remember, and then all of a sudden you're not going to remember because the mind has gone asleep. Right, so it's gone into causal, you're not going to remember. But you'll remember everything, going to sleep, and then you'll remember waking up. Okay? The conscious mind will remember in terms of subject-object duality on both ends. But the deep sleep state is not a remembering of subject-object duality, because the subject, the mind, has gone into unmanifest condition, so there is no subject-object duality. But the mind is still there in its causal condition. And so when you wake up from that, you can talk about what happened. Like, even if you say, you know, I remember I was going to sleep. This is the day of the dogs. Just today. This is the dog day for all of us. Yeah. So anyway, you remember this sequence of not knowing anything. Even if you say 6 hours passed, I had no recollection of that. There was no marking of time. I didn't know anything. So you were there, but you didn't die. You didn't die, right? There's no marking. During that time, there's no duality. There's no marking of time, but you were present before, during, and after. So you have to say that in between the going to sleep, where there's a duality, subject-object, and the waking up, there's a duality. In the middle, I don't know anything, because that's the experience. Now, in samadhi, in nirvikalpa samadhi, there's a little difference. You go into that nirvikalpa state. There is no subject-object duality. There is no marking of time whatsoever. But when you come out of that state, you know, you remember going into the state, and when you're in that state, means the mind has totally resolved itself into the Atma. There is only non-dual Atma. There's no subject-object. There's nobody saying, oh, look, I'm aware. This is nirvikalpa samadhi. I'm aware of this. No. There's only just simply your being. Then you come out of that, and there's two things. You are very aware that you had that experience. It's no marking of time at all. You're totally free of time. Time before, time after. But you totally remember that time. And there's another thing, is that you also notice, if you've had teaching, you also notice that you are still there. Even though the mind has gone into the experience, so the mind totally resolved and there's no subject-object relationship, when the mind comes out of that experience, there's a recognition of your own being that's the anuvritti in all experiences. Whether the mind is in a resolved experience, resolves into the self, or is in a waking state or a dream state or going through different vrittis in the world, just generated by your sense perception, your being is ever present because it's self-evident. And so the self-evident me, I was just there all by myself without any experience of duality. But then when the mitya duality comes, I'm still exactly there in exactly the same way, in that viveka is now very, very complete. But in between, there's no marking of time at all. So the difference is, in the one state, you are in complete ajnanam. In the other state, the mind is totally resolved into the Atma. But in both of them, there's no marking of time. So I say, you can't say, oh, I was in Nirvikalpa Samadhi for hours. There is no time. There's no time being marked. So if you were there for 2 seconds or 5 hours, it wouldn't make any difference because there's no marking of time. The marking of time is only from the experience, from the subject-object experience within the world of change. So you might contemplate on that a little bit.
On Nirvikalpa Samadhi?
Why I'm saying that there's a similar... I want you to kind of try to understand the similarity.
Mm-hmm.
Because in both cases, there's no marking of time.
Okay.
At all. You know, so that's why... From the standpoint of the body and the lost moments of experience, that can be interesting to you. But from the standpoint of the deep sleep or the Nirvikalpa Samadhi, there's no time at all because there's nothing to mark the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to mark the time only when you're out of that state, and then you can look at the clock and say, "Oh wow, I was really, really asleep. I can't believe it's already 6 a.m." You know. And you could say, I usually wake up at night. Tonight I didn't wake up at all. I slept really well. But you're remembering, you're recalling your experience. You're not using an inference. You know, what would the inference be, do you think?
Well, that I must have been soundly sleeping. Because I lay down and I got up and it was much later. But maybe I just need to look at my experience more carefully.
Yeah, I think you have to do that. And also, I think that if you were using an inference, that would actually be what we call postulation, more of a postulation. Postulation is that this is the only thing that this could be. Like, for instance, I don't think it is a postulation. I'm satisfied with the memory. But say you took it as a postulation. The example for a postulation is, Shweta. is wearing my brain out. Anyway, let me tell you about this postulation. It's a simple example, really, but if you wake up in the morning and everything is wet, there's only one thing that can, all outside, wet, puddles, everything, everywhere. There is no other thing you can think of that you even know about that could cause that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that makes you able to say, well, it must have rained.
Right.
Even though that certainly was not my experience. I wasn't near the rain. I didn't hear the rain. You know, but when I go wake up and I see that it rained, I can postulate it must have rained outside because there's nothing else that could do that. That's a postulation. In a way, it's close to inference. In a way, it's not. An inference, two things have to have some sort of concomitance to make you, that happening at the same time, to make you recognize that when this is happening, that must be happening. Mm. That's an inference. It's called in Indian logic, it's called anumana. And so,
is that the if and only if, or?
I don't know the English terms for it.
Oh.
But there is a knowledge of deep sleep, because there is a memory of deep sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, it's your immediate experience and you're recollecting it.
That's the difference. Even though there's no objectification during that time. So
there's no objectification.
Smack it off.
God. What are we going to do with you? You're not little good little ashramites. You live in your own world. I know.
So in some ways there's a similarity. In another way there's a complete dissimilarity.
Between what?
The deep sleep and your miracles.
Oh, yeah.
There's a similarity.
The similarity...
I use it as an example sometimes.
But the similarity is a real similarity, and there's no marking of time in either one.
Time, yeah.
Yeah. And so you could be in nirvikalpa samadhi for days, and there's no marking of time for you. It's only when you come out, you know, that there's a marking of time. When you look back at the dates and all of that, and then you find out everything that was happened, but from your perspective, there's no marking of time. But you, now that your mind is now in out of that condition, the non-dual condition of the self, where there's no marking of time, or in the causal condition of complete ignorance, and the mind goes into that causal condition, there's no marking of time. So what is the relationship when you come out to that experience? It's an experience that...
The memory.
Yeah, the memory. I think it's very clear, this is very clear in reference to nirvikalpa samadhi, because you're experiencing the non-dual self that you are so... Come over here. Come over here. This is your place here. Just sit down there. That's okay. The non-dual self is just self-evident, and you realize the truth of yourself. With all this viveka has taken place, and then that's what you remember when you come out of it. And the one who was there just by yourself is the one who is here now with the smile. You know, and so there's a big learning that goes on here in the nirvikalpa. It's a huge learning. Because what the nirvikalpa that you were just abiding at is the nirvikalpa that's still here when the mind comes out and the body and all the perceptions are there. Whereas in Ajnanam, when you go to deep sleep, it's not exactly a learning experience. You come out and you say, well, when I'm deep sleep, I didn't know anything at all. The mind, the vritti that the mind assumes is just one of pure Ajnanam, and that's what is being illumined. Okay, so one more thing that may help. Okay. The fact is, when we analyze, say when we just do the simple drip drisha viveka, see or seeing, in that you're awake, so we don't have this problem. Okay. When you're awake, you recognize that the body, the sense organs, the mind, all of the vrittis are all maya, right? They're differentiated from you, and that your being is free from that, right? And so in all of those experiences, because the mind is there, there's a subject-object relationship. This is known, this is known, this is known. That's continual, right? Anything that's there because of the sattva is going to reflect or enjoy knownness. Right? But now you think that in order for something to be experienced, I need to be objectifying a subject-object relationship. Know or known. The whole know or known is objectified. But since there's a know or known that's being objectified, I can account for that experience. Whereas if the know or known dyad is in unmanifest or causal condition, even though the sattva is there, I can't account for that. That's kind of what you're saying. Only these kind of vrittis can be illumined, not the ajnana vrittis. You know, if you say that the jnana vritti is not illumined, that there's no vritti there to be known, to be illumined, to have knownness shining upon it, because there is no knower, right? Then you'll think, well, I must infer, or I must presume that I was there, because there's nothing in between. But in fact, you were there, and the vritti was there, but the vritti is devoid of subject-object relationship, and so there's a feeling that you can't verify it without the subject-object relationship taking place in the vritti. And it's easier then you can say, well, but in nirvikalpa samadhi, you can verify it because you're awake, it's yourself, there's no duality, there's no jnanam there. And when you come out of it, you've learned something very, very important, that yourself is ever-present, which we've used through all of these other prakriyas, you've seen that. Now the mind has resolved into that, and you feel that viveka is now complete. There's been a big learning there. You know, so something has happened. But when it's just ajnanam, nothing has happened, and that nothing happening is what's illumined. The big I don't know. That's why I'm juggling. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe just play around with that. Think about that, and then we can go at it again. You look kind of happy. Mm-hmm. Are you happy?
So when we go to sleep, mm-hmm. and the mind goes to sleep, how can it come then that, for instance, I can decide, like, I want to wake up in 6 hours, or I want to wake up that time? And I wake up that time.
Yeah, it's an auto-suggestion. And the mind can mark that.
But if the mind goes to sleep, how can it still
do that?
Yeah.
That's a good question. It's not going to... I like that question. I like them all, actually, but that's one I hadn't quite thought of in that way. Because we do experience that all of the time. Mm-hmm. Your mind and your... the sukshma sharira cannot be completely asleep. It can't be, because there's still all of the prana and all of so many functions are going on, even though the mind is not functioning in terms of a subject object. I would look at it maybe like this. Your unconscious is working all the time. You know? Jung will say there's an ongoing dream underneath the conscious mind. There's also conversations, agitations, continual learning going on in the unconscious mind. And so when you make an auto-suggestion, that you're making that auto-suggestion not really to the conscious mind, to the unconscious mind. And then that throws the switch on when the time is right. Now there's other interesting things about your unconscious, and even unconscious in animals, they found this. Like if say you come upon, say you had the anniversary of your partner's death or something that was an impactful situation. When that anniversary rolls around that day, even though you may not be thinking of it, your unconscious remembers it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so you'll find yourself grieving or things being a little amiss, and then you'll remember what it was. Mm-hmm. But the unconscious remembers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that makes me think of that when you make an auto suggestion. Because I do that too. I said I want to wake up at 6, and I wake up at 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not going to be the conscious mind.
So. Well, part of the mind must be aware of. Or the surroundings, because you could say the fire alarm or someone enters the room, the mind sort of is alert once again.
Yeah, I think there's the level of the unconscious. But, so that's a complexity also. This is going to be something that you have to ponder.
Yeah. It reminds me, I don't know if this is related at all, but there was some Zen master who said, look, when an owl makes a cry, you hear it. You weren't waiting for the owl. You weren't expecting for the owl. It just happens. It's a part of the mind that's just aware that you don't really have to do anything about. He thought that was very important.
Yeah, exactly. I would be surprised if they comes in boiling mad. Shretha!
Is it Mitch Mitchell?
Emotions. Yeah, I mean, wouldn't Dave phone here?
No.
I have no idea. I don't know anything.
He'd rather come and be physical.
I mean, the phone's on point, do you think?
Oh, lucky ducky.
Yeah, good boy.
Lucky ducky.
Someone
honked?
Yeah.
Okay.
Prison. You want me to go out and be with the
dogs? With what?
You want me to go with the dogs?
No. They should be quiet.
Where's my shoes?
Thank goodness it's with you.
What happened last time is he had a young dog, so his dog is barking.
Sorry,
everything's
barking.
Try again or something.
Yeah, but his dog is doing the same thing, so.
Thanks. Sometimes blog doesn't always follow anger.
Doris, I
see that it was kind of dumb. He's not a
class lady.
Aww.
I think it's a golden muscle.
No, I bought a collie for it.
It's a farm dog.
You know what? Those things, those animals or whatever, are screeching out there. It's not the dogs. What is that?
It's really strange. It was mule deer and heat.
Huh?
Were you saying that, Barry? That it was
deer messing around.
It's like someone's getting murdered.
Yeah, it's really intense. It goes on and on. So maybe that's why they're so.
But he was beating the horn.
Mitchell, he didn't do it on purpose.
Oh, okay. Oh, you had an eventful day today.
We've had an event. Well, screeching, barking.
We had a little bit. Until we found the right spot.
I heard the spot was really beautiful, though.
Oh, yes.
What's in there? Oh, good.
I'm sorry that I'm interrupting you guys.
No, we're really glad to see you.
That's two different things. Two different issues.
We have other
a lot of characters are still here, I see.
Yep.
This is Mitchell, everyone.
Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, everybody I know and don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there might be a few changing of the guards here.
There's a few.
You made it.
You need a hand?
We got a hand.
No, no, we got it.
Do you want to talk about prasad or like, like there's good and bad, you know, pleasurable and pleasurable, but then there's like the underlying, just the consciousness. That we could settle into that, but you still have the preferences. And
preferences aren't really a problem. It'd be weird not to have them. The problem is if the preference is, like, if we can use the word preference, that's pretty benign. And that a preference would be a non-binding desire. If you don't get your way, it's okay. A binding desire is not exactly a preference. It means if I don't get my way, I'm really not okay. I get upset and angry and all these kind of things because it's a binding desire. But you can't, it's not like you gain knowledge and you're no longer human. You gain knowledge, you're human, you have desires and you have preferences and all of that type of thing, and you have emotions and you have, you're a person, you know? But the mind is not problematic for you because you're not asking the world to be different. You're experiencing the world as Ishvara, really. Mm-hmm. And you have to put up with all of the annoying things that happen, but you're not saying, I'm no longer happy because of all these annoying things. nor are you expecting that there aren't going to be annoying things, yeah, or difficult things. It's how it is.
Is prasad like, is there a sense of like this is a gift or this is an annoyance that happens to be from Bhagwan, or is it like Bhagwan
prasad
himself?
Prasada buddhi. You mean prasada buddhi?
Yeah, the prasada buddhi.
Accepting whatever. Is it like, oh, this is the Lord, even though it feels terrible?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, say, if you set yourself up in life like everything's supposed to go well, yeah, that's a real problem. Yeah. You know, if you take, like, I love Jagadisha's thing, you know, this is not Swargaloka, you know? It's not Swargaloka here. That means it's 50-50. Sometimes the whole, and but what they mean is sometimes the situation you find yourself in is designed to irritate you. Now, that doesn't mean you'll be irritated. You don't have to be irritated, but it's designed to be an irritating situation. And with knowledge, you can just, it's a non-binding desire, and okay, this is how it is now, let me just handle it, whatever it is. And my mind doesn't get all crazy. But if it's a binding desire, then Bhagawan's kind of got you. Because 50% of the situations are relatively nice, they're in the positive spectrum. 50% of the situations are really challenging, you know. They're not meant at all to make you happy. You know, and that's because from the kind of the Hindu cosmology of things that this loka, this human loka where you have free will and you can gain knowledge, it's a very important loka. The others are really just exhausting karmas. But this one, you're both exhausting karmas and you have free will, you know, to how you respond to the karmas. And so you're accruing more karma also. But they say that in this loka, the punya papa is a mix, like 50%, 50-50. And, you know, it could be 50-50 is just approximate, you know. And if you look at your life, there's, for all of us, and I even look at Swamiji's life all the way through, from as long as I knew him, it was 50-50. He didn't respond to the situations that way. But there were really many, really hard, very difficult situations. He handled them beautifully. But that doesn't mean those situations were designed to make him happy. He was happy because he wasn't dependent on the situations for his happiness. You know? And even in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, there's all kinds of situations that Rama goes through, that Krishna goes through, that Arjuna went through, that are extremely challenging, very unfair, you know. So it depends on how you are. We can all do well, pretty well, in the happy situations, but it's the hard situations that kind of rip us to shreds. depending solely on our attitude. The only way out of this is our attitude, because the universe isn't going to say, well, she's such a good girl, let's let's make everything work right for her. Now, it's all internal. Freedom is internal. Yourself is ever free, so there's no problem with yourself. But in terms of your own shanti, it has to do with your knowledge, your understanding of the world, your understanding of yourself and how to be with it. You know, if you're just you don't have any self-knowledge, then it kind of has to do with a certain spirituality that includes dharma, adharma, from I think an Eastern perspective. You know, there's a realization, there's an understanding that there's something greater than yourself here, you know. And there's an understanding of dharma.
This 50-50, I haven't had anybody even say that, but it makes so much sense. Is there anything that any way how you sort of get that 50-50 proportion?
What do you mean? That's
they're saying it's 50-50. It's extremely logical.
Yeah.
And it's only you that I have heard it from.
I've heard it from Swamiji.
You heard it from Swamiji?
Yeah,
okay.
I didn't just decide that.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely
okay,
not.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's very, so logical.
Yeah.
But sometimes it sort of seems when the knowledge is being gained or after it's gained, that it's, that, you know, the 50-50 proportion speaks more to maybe like 70-30 or 80-20.
But that's with knowledge. This doesn't apply at all, because the reason that something is not causing you pain is because of your attitude toward it. Whereas if you just have a samsari attitude toward it, you know, it's a situation that you would not desire.
Mm.
And so then you can have a reaction to not getting your way, and, you know, why is life so cruel to me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of that. It's all, everything's really how you are with it. Your emotions, your reactions, it all has to do with how you hold the situation in terms of your own well-being. How does the situation affect your own happiness?
Well, today my mind really got the
Well, I got pretty riled myself with my poor little dogs screeching into my ears. Screeching is still in there somehow.
But is there like certain situations in the world where it's appropriate to have pain, like a death of a loved one? Or
yeah,
something?
It's appropriate. It is appropriate. It's natural. It's built into the creation. But then, how much do you build up on that?
Right.
Because the grief is actually, I feel, very sacred.
Right.
You know, it's something. It's built in, and it's
honoring.
It's a deep honoring of the person. You know.
Screeching is compassion for the dog's agitation. It's an expression of love.
See, that was even screeching at you right there.
Mm. Just thank you, Lara.
My screechy dogs, my screechy ones. You got a name, Shweta Screechy.
Screech.
Where's Screechy?
Saved by the Bell. Screech.
Screechy and howling. Where's Howley? Where's the howler?
That's
Where's
nice.
Screechy?
Knocking at the door.
Yeah.
Right, going back to Rick's question earlier about the subject-object relationship, and we talked a little bit yesterday about when you remember a dream and you kind of imprint it in your mind. Is there like a layer of that dream that if you don't take the time to imprint it, is layered on your subconscious still? I get sometimes these wildly strong feelings of all I can relate to them is deja vu of I know what's about to happen, I know. Oh, I've never been to this place, but I've been to this place, and I've seen this place, and I know how these next few events are going to unfold. Is that from a dream state? Is that from something else?
Yeah, it's some sort of a deja vu. But, yeah, who was it? Was it Terry? Where's Terry?
She's
in bed.
Sleeping, yeah.
Yep. So is Emma. Some of us are quite tired. Yeah, that deja vu, I don't really know how to answer that, but what I think is that, you know, with psychic experiences, a lot of times there's foresight of, you know, something that's going to happen. And with the deja vu, it's something akin to that, where you know you've already been there.
Mm.
You know what it is. So it's already, somehow it's already happened. Or you've had a premonition of it. So you may have had a premonition even in the unconscious.
Yes.
And then when it happens, you know it. When you're actually there in the event, you already know it. Because you've had some sort of premonition that may have gone back into kind of a causal condition because you didn't grab it in the deep sleep state. Or another thing that I've noticed is that, I don't think this is right. I've noticed it, I don't know that it addresses this, but, you know, intuitions, kind of knowing of things, will pass through and you don't catch them. You don't pay attention. There's just psychic things going on all the time for us. And when it's like a deja vu, or you've been here, you know, you're familiar with that event, that's like there was a premonition that you didn't get. And now that you're here, you get it. When the premonition is taking place, actually, now you're here in the actuality of it. But you already know, even though you didn't know before, it's because your mind didn't imprint it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Not quite?
No, I think it does. And so,
yeah.
Is it on some layer maybe like an imprint of a dream in your subconscious?
Yeah, you've experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
You've experienced it, but it didn't quite make it up to consciousness to be a memory. So the memory comes when you actually experience the event as a deja vu. But actually there's other ways of that maybe you were actually in that situation another life, but
mm-hmm.
I think this experience makes a lot of, this way of explaining it makes a lot of sense.
I mean, there are also theories of multi-universes going on all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
If you step it from one to the other.
That's true too, but that could be like in a more of a dream state or in a subconscious state, because it didn't, that experience didn't take place in consciousness, or you would already know that.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be a deja vu. It would be you had a premonition and now here it is. Now it's happening. That's not deja vu. I had this premonition and now this is happening and here it is. This is exactly what I saw earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you may have had the premonition in your unconscious or just made it on a subliminal level, and then when it actually happens, you remember it. And so that's a deja vu, because you've never been here before, you know you haven't. But the deja vu has to do with the premonition. Maybe.
At some level, is it your mind, you were talking about postulating? Is it your subconscious postulating maybe about?
No, because with the deja vu, you've been there before and you know it, but you know you've never been there before. So what accounts for that? Then you can think, that's one way of explaining it.
Couldn't
I had this as a premonition.
A similar event has happened before. It's like sort of being in class. Sometimes you think, wow, this is like being in Swargat, you know, that it's just such a great experience. And then you sort of feel as though, you know, you've experienced being, say, in your class before and before and before, and then the feeling is exactly the same.
But that's a memory. Because you're in the class and you have a big absorption and it's a very beautiful experience. And then you remember, you know, I've had this experience in many other classes.
The very first time, like in Sue's class, or the first time I was in Berkeley, in your class.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a wow. It's such an amazing experience. It's just like, I said, wow, I've been here before. I've been here, like it's like coming into Svarboloka again, being taught.
Oh, I see.
Mm.
It's like what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, for the very first
except
time.
For the very first
it's
time.
Just, and it's just amazing.
It's a, yeah. I've had kind of an experience like that. I think people say, let me see if this is the same. It's like when you first come to this knowledge and it's unfolding and you get it, you see it. It is, could not be more familiar because it's yourself. And the feeling is, like I felt for Swamiji, he's putting into words something that I've always known but was never able to bring forward. But it's not like you're hearing something that you don't know. Because the fact is that you have always known it in terms of experience, but not in terms of words. And so now there's words that are clarifying this experience in a way. But you've always had the experience. So that's somehow... That's not deja vu. But that's, I'm talking about his experience. Yeah. That's not deja vu.
I totally understand that. And it's just when Swamiji would sort of talk, it just seems so obvious. So obvious and thoughtful. Well, how come I never thought of it before? Would so obvious.
Yeah.
But this is a slightly different. I mean, I don't want to sort of, it's not a big deal. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating and interesting. That's all.
Shankar says that very thing in his Adyasabhasya, the Brahma Sutras. How on earth could this be? Because when it's unfolded and you see it, it's so obvious. How could you not know this? How could you have missed this? You know, it's just logical and it's, you see it clearly, and how come we never thought of this? He said it's like the difference between night and day. That's what he says.
I feel sometimes if something really clicks, because I think, I don't know, is it not likely many of us have studied this knowledge before?
Yeah, even in last life.
So mm-hmm. I've had
keep picking up the thread.
Like, aha, there, I knew that before, and now I know it in this
yeah.
life.
Yeah. That's interesting. Because they do say we pick up the thread.
Yeah.
Some people are coming to this knowledge for the first time. Other people didn't quite get it in the last life. It didn't all gel. So you take another birth, and the Shastra says, then you'll pick up the thread in the next birth. So you're picking up the thread. Yeah. There's no way not to pick up the thread, really. Does it make sense? Because a mumukshu is different than a samsari in terms of the whole orientation toward life. The mumukshu is now needs to know the truth because you realize that the creation isn't working as you thought it was supposed to work. Right? You realize, you see through that. And so now you need something else. And so the karmas that are attracted to you, if you've realized that, will be karmas around moksha and picking up the thread, not about going back into samsara because that's over.
You recognize the limitations of it.
Yeah, it's just not at all the same. You've seen through that, and you can't go back. That's what I was telling the other night about Arjuna Ubhayabhrashta, where he was really worried he was get killed in the battlefield. You know, in the Mahabharata war, you get killed on the battlefield, and then what? He can't go back to the samsara, and he hasn't realized this, so he's just lost on either way. And Bhagavan says, no, that won't happen. You'll either be born in the house of jnanis, and you'll pick up the thread right away, or depending upon your needs, you'll exhaust some karmas, and then you'll meet your teacher and pick up the thread and go.
And that would be the case for the majority, great majority of us. You meet the teacher sort of in your 20s or something like that.
Or something like that. Yeah. Or it could be that you're just, now in this life, you're just ready for this knowledge and you meet your teacher. And it's not coming over from it having been taught this from a past life, but wasn't completed. It could be many different things. Yeah.
For me, it seems like it's easier to difference. Like I'm not the body, I'm not my feelings, I'm not my emotions and thoughts. But there seems to be sticky with my history, my story, my conclusions that I made early in life. Is that just working with the inner child to release these? Because there seems to be sticky conclusions that I made early in my life and like holding my story. Like there seems to be identification.
Yeah, because those conclusions you are very invested in.
They might not even, they are not serving me either.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of webs, mm-hmm. you know. And there's reasons for those conclusions that involve a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. And so there's and for children, a lot of those emotions and the kind of the conclusions are there in the unconscious. Mm-hmm. So they're very strong. Mm-hmm. Some of those childhood conclusions are almost structural in the psyche. And so there's no promise that you ever get rid of some of them, but they become mitya. Mm-hmm. You know. But some of the conclusions are so deep, you know, that your whole psyche is grown around them. Mm-hmm. When they become mitya for you, then you know how to be with them. You know, and so say there's a little child inside who doesn't feel wanted or doesn't feel loved. This is kind of the ailment of our time. But you can be with that part and make it much, much better. But sometimes you have to live around it and let that part be with you and take care of it. And it's not a promise that it will completely go away. Just in psychology we know that too, because it's almost structural. And so your whole life is built around that conclusion as you grow up. And so it's rooted into, it kind of finds itself as central as you grow up to all the way you feel and all the way you think and the way you relate to others. This is, even if you build little edifices on top of it, still down at the bottom, that's the conclusion.
Yeah. But can I still gain moksha?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. You have to take care of the little one.
Yeah.
Say, that's all right. I love you. Don't worry.
Yeah. It's kind of nice. It's nice work.
Yeah, it's very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but you know, we're all carrying our childhood experiences around with us in a structural way. You know, and so you can just love and kindness toward those kind of deep-rooted problems and knowing that they're mitya, and then being able to, you do the inner child work, but it that inner child work also grows to a point of where it's the self that is holding the unloved or unwanted little child. Yeah. Almost everybody has some in this era, Kali Yuga era, has some of that, because very few parents are able to give the children the amount of love and attention that they need in order to for them to really develop fully. It's a hard thing. Some people were very, very fortunate. It's huge punya. If your parents were the kind of parents where you were the absolute center of attention, not in terms of being spoiled, but in terms of being loved, you know. I haven't really experienced it in this country like I have in India. I have experienced that in India, the way the parents are with their children. Mm-hmm. Their children they want their children to be with them all the time.
Is that the theory behind like attachment parenting?
What?
Is that the theory behind like attachment parenting?
Probably. The attachment parenting is normal and really, really important. Without it, a child or a little, they did it with eight babies and things. They'll die. Mm. You know? Hi.
Probably these days in the West, the parents just haven't got the time.
They don't have the time, and they're irritated and tired, and they have their desires and whatnot.
And the
family, for the mother, the mothers are working, the fathers are working, they're scrambling for, well, both people have to work now, even if they don't want to, in most cases, to have enough money. And the kids go into nursery school and all this kind of stuff. I remember, I've told the story before, but the story shocked me that Swamiji told, because I just never thought of it. But what he said was, when he got to the States and they were driving along the freeway, you know, going from town to town or whatever, he would see the mother over and over, and this over and over and over, he said, over and over I saw this. The mother and the father were sitting in the front seat, and the children were all in the back seat. They were left in the back seat by themselves. And he was almost horrified. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why wasn't the mother in the back seat with her children? Mm-hmm. You know, it really bothered him. Mm-hmm. It really bothered him, really. Like, they're all alone back there. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all... And the parents are, you know, carrying on their conversation, listening to them, doing whatever they're doing, and the kids are in the back by themselves. The mother should be back there with them.
With the TV and the headphones.
Because in India, it's different.
It's different. Mm. Yeah. Wow. But he had quite a reaction to that. Mm. I really thought about it. I thought, wow, that's... But when I was in India, I used to always... And, of course, I don't really know how... I'm not in India that... long for long, or when I was really there for years. It was in the 70s. And the children just hung on to the mother's sari and just went everywhere she went. And she wanted them to be everywhere she went. They were like little ducklings. And wherever she went, her little ducklings were there with her. But you know what? Those kids were like well-formed little beings, little people. Little three-year-old people, you know, that had something to say, and they were important little beings.
And they were happy.
And they were so happy and so confident and so secure, because they were filled up with that type of self-esteem, you know. So all of that love and attention for a little child creates a structural self-esteem for them. We talk in psychology. Structural, you know. Mm-hmm. But say that for whatever reason you weren't able to get that from your parents. Mm-hmm. And so then there's a different senses of, you know, not being wanted or not being loved. Nobody loves me. Nobody really loves me. You don't know how common that is.
Like the abandoned child syndrome.
Yeah. Well, yeah, or but if you weren't abandoned, so you don't necessarily...
No, but the
Did you need to go outside? You need to go potty or something, huh?
Like the child feels that they're being abandoned from not wanted.
Yeah, not wanted. And they don't have those words.
Yeah.
They don't know that. But they're suffering, you know.
If there's that hole there of not feeling inherently... whole or whatever. It seems like maybe more in the West there's this sense of trying to possess the self or like earn the love or...
Yeah.
And I see that happening in the spiritual community a little bit, like using the path as a way to make a certain feeling be gained as opposed to finding how it's already there.
Yeah, I think I don't know about that, but I think that you want to gain that feeling, but the real gain is finding out it's already there. But there'll be in the unconscious, there's a need to, you would like to feel loved. Everyone would like to be feel loved. And to what degree, in terms of the mind or the psyche, you can have that is, it's not a given, but it is a given for the nature of yourself. And when that nature of the self, when the little ones inside, or the psyche inside, is held by the nature of yourself, and you let the self and the pain or the hurt or the complexes relax into that, they start to to let go of some of the affect so that you're not holding as much affect or as much pain inside. What are you doing? But there can still be structural things, you know.
Do you know, I kind of explain why it's so much more powerful to get validation from another rather than as much as we could practice giving it to ourselves. Having someone else do it for us, it seems to have more weight.
It can initially, because the psyche itself isn't, it needs to, it can't give it to itself. At some it depends on the level of development, but sometimes in that inner child relationship, it's okay. He's got to go outside soon. He'll be okay. That being able to really separate the buddhi from the one who's in pain, that they're not able to do that, make that separation so well.
So we should.
So when
can
that
get there, it's
yeah,
a process to get there.
Yeah.
But in time, our own validation should be as good as anyone else's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes, if you, it's very helpful to have therapy, because then you can get that from another person until your mind is able to give it.
Mm, that's not cheating.
That's not cheating.
Yeah.
No, because then what happens is the therapist on an unconscious level for you is giving to that part what it didn't get.
Yeah.
And so you may not have the strength, the client may have not had the strength to do that themselves, but if they're in therapy and there's transference is there with the therapist, then that can all be healed really beautifully. Amazing that therapy can be extraordinary when the therapist becomes the one who can give that kind of unconditional love and support. It's really not to the adult. It's happening on an unconscious level with the little one. So that therapeutic alliance or the compatibility is really important. You know, I would tell clients that when you're going to interviewing, that they want to know their daughter wants therapy or something like that. And if you're a therapist, you can't really see more in the type of therapy I was doing. You never take anybody's friends or family members or even somebody who's known to them at work, because it compromises the confidentiality and the trust of the therapeutic container. So you don't do that, because then some part of your mind can think, well, I wonder what she's saying to my therapist. Or it's called a leaky container. So if I'm, so then I will send friends of my clients to different people. But what I tell them, if you're go to see a therapist for the first time to see if they're a good fit, you have to see what the little one inside, how the little one inside feels. You know, if you get, it's almost on an unconscious level, if you get an okay, you know, or some feeling that this is good, this is what I want to do, that's what you want to hear. That part of the unconscious wants to be with this first person as their mommy or daddy. Even though we don't say those words. And then that therapy can be really effective. Or you can just feel on an ego level also that, oh, I think this will work. I want, it's more like, not I think this will work, it's more like, I want to do it with this person. And that's not, it's not intellectual. It's on a feeling level, you know. Well, this person has all the right qualifications. You know. So what? It's nice they have the qualifications. They have very good training, very good qualifications, very good reputation, but they might not be a good fit for you. You need a person who's well qualified, but they have to be a good fit for you. And if they're not, then it doesn't matter how qualified they are. And it's on a deep level, it's not on a superficial level.
What does validation mean in the process of the self? Like, resolving the ego into the self is something you wrote about, I think, or like validation is important. So why, like, what does that mean, validation?
What? Who's using the word?
Like for the buddhi, or is it, the part of the self that identifies with its own characteristics as a system, or wants to recognize its inherent goodness, or wants to be good or not be bad or whatever.
Well,
loved.
Okay, wants to be loved. That's another word we use for that is mirroring. Mm-hmm. And mirroring, I think that's kind of the right word for it, even a better word than validation. Because mirroring is a type of validation. It's like when, say you're talking to somebody, then there's a dance going on between the two psyches, really, where the other person is facially, with their eyes, with their expression, even with their body language, is responding to you, you know? So there's a response going on, so you feel heard, or you feel seen. There's a validation the two of you are communicating. But say you're trying to talk with somebody and they're just looking at you with no facial expression, no body language. It's like you don't exist. There's no mirroring. Mirroring is also subtle. You know, your movements and your facial expression, it just lines up, is in tune. It's not even really conscious. Mm. It just lines up, it's in tune with the other person. And then you feel comfortable, you feel, we don't even use the word validated, but really, you're in tune with each other and conversation is going on and it feels really good. But now, say you get in a conversation with somebody who really could care less about you and doesn't particularly want to be talking to you. So you're talking and trying to relate and all that, there's something wrong. There's something wrong because they are not responding. And you don't even know how to think about it because a lot of the levels of response are all body language, but you're not doing any body language. Body language takes place. So you're not even aware of your body language. You know, but all of it is taking place and all of the way the eyes and facial expressions are connecting. You know, the psyche feels all of that. They did that horrible, in the 40s, they did that horrible, horrible experiment, which has been banned for decades, mm-hmm. of where they had a little baby, little infant on the lap of the mother, and she was told, her job was to just let the baby relate to you, but don't you do no expression. Don't get any expression at all. And so the baby was trying and trying and then trying, you know, and trying different things, but no expression. And finally the baby just decompensated.
What?
Decompensated. Just went into a screaming, frightful rage. Just out. Decompensation means they just can't hold on to anything anymore. They're just screaming and crying and frightened, and can you imagine doing it? Anyway, they were, all those things were outlawed. They used to do really terrible experiments, not realizing that it would have the deleterious effects it would have, you know, on the child or on animals. Oh, don't even go there. Horrible.
On the subtle level, though, if somebody's with me in the self, like they don't need to be. We could just be sitting in a room together, and it could be really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's mirroring. You don't have to be talking, you know. But you can also feel sitting in the room together with somebody where it's not comfortable at all. And you're not talking. And you're sitting on the other side of the room. It's not comfortable.
Like if I want to be loved for my stuff, and the other person just says, like, okay, this is the self, you know. You don't have to be that way. Then there's like a.
They're missing.
Because I, like, as the one who wants to be the special person or whatever, secretly I want that because I want to be just with the person or, like, on the level of the self together, and I feel this, like, rift, like I'm alienated from my real self and from another person, and there's this all like management going on and missing.
You know. I would suggest,
I'm not saying it.
Yeah, just close your eyes and take some deep breaths, and that happens. You have to reboot.
I'm just saying from memory, yeah. Kind of bounces off each other sometimes.
Yeah, not in the right, not in a comfortable way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Complicated world we live in.
With Erin, I mean, look, say 95% of the time, if there is sort of a wish for validation or self praise, you can give that to the little ones. But the other 5% of the time, it is nice to get that validation and that feedback from another person.
Yeah,
it's always nice.
Yeah, and if it's not there, then what can we give more and more until it does eventually come?
From the other person?
Yeah, yes. Or from any
person. Yeah.
It doesn't matter which person.
Yeah. Om Swasti Prajapya Padmapalyantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahisha Go Brahmanebhya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parijanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Barahitah Pramana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukkha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amatangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.